as far as cosmology is concerned. Last time we studied cosmological singularities, we showed that under very general conditions, we arrive at a cosmological singularity at the beginning of the universe. This is reassuring to know, because it means that if we find solutions, explicit solutions of the Einstein equations that show singularities, then we don't have to fear that the singularities might be an artifact of the extreme symmetry. We have singularity theorems that show us singularities are unavoidable even when the symmetry is not present. Symmetry, though, is still very important. And it's important because the Einstein equations are equations of multiple components, coupled partial differential equations that are nonlinear, very hard to solve. And if we want to solve the Einstein equations, we have to rely on symmetry, just to reduce the number of degrees of freedom. So today, we will look at the question, how many cosmological solutions to the Einstein equation can we find if we assume symmetry? And what kind of singularities do we end up with when we do that? So it will be all about the classification of cosmological exact solutions and the singularities that they involve. On the Thursday, then, we will go into the explicit, much more detail into the explicit calculations that we use to derive the most likely description of the universe. But today we will ask for all kinds of solutions that can arise to the Einstein equation if you want symmetry. So remember that in the classification of cosmological models, the idea is to solve the Einstein equation together with the equations of motion. The Einstein equation looks like that, distinct Einstein tensor, and the equations of motion, well, of matter depends on what matter fields we take into account. In practice, this problem is intractable because it has too many variables, and the differential equations involved are too complicated. So we simplify this problem by making symmetry assumptions. As I already mentioned, there are potential problems with symmetry assumptions because the then obtained solutions with those high symmetries may have properties that are peculiar to the symmetry and properties that would not hold if the symmetry was just a little bit variable. In particular, we question the robustness of the cosmological singularity that is present in the Friedmann-Lemaître model, or the Friedmann-Lemaître solution to the Einstein equation. But we saw that there are singularity theorems that confirm this robustness, and therefore we have more confidence in studying and taking seriously the properties of highly symmetric solutions. So our strategy now is this. We will classify cosmological models. And a cosmological model is a space-time manifold with a metric and some energy-momentum tensor by the amount of symmetry and by the type of symmetry that is being assumed. For each amount and type of the symmetry, we will try to find, or actually you will not have time to actively search for those solutions, but I will give you an overview of which solutions have been found. And we will also discuss the properties of those exact solutions that have been found, what kind of singularities that they involve. See, it's not as simple as there was a singularity at the Big Bang, or there was. There can be many different kinds of singularities at the beginning of the universe, and we will see how they arise. And eventually, not today, but on Thursday, we will focus on those space-time manifolds with high symmetry, on those solutions to the Einstein equation with high symmetry that appear to approximate the real world with quite some precision, and that would be the Friedmann Lemaître model. However, we should not sweep the other solutions under the rug so quickly. Let's just think about the limitations to this argument. The argument being, well, why should we look at general solutions to the Einstein equation, general cosmological solutions to the Einstein equation, if we know that the true solution is the Friedmann-Lemaître model? Well, just keep in mind that there are some rather non-trivial things happening with other solutions other than Friedmann-Lemaître. For one, there are some solutions to the Einstein equation, cosmological solutions, which come arbitrarily close to a Friedmann-Lemaître solution at finite time, and then deviate from it significantly. And this can only happen because the equations involved are highly nonlinear. So in principle, it's possible that we are fooled into thinking that we live in a Friedmann-Lemaître universe. And in reality, the dynamics is much more complicated, and we just happen to be close to a Friedmann-Lemaître universe at the moment, or I mean, for some billions of light years, billions of years. And before and after, the deviations may be large. Also, in quantum gravity, in principle, all manifolds with all metric structures contributes to the quantum field theoretical part in the question. Not just the classical solution, which comes closest to what we see, but in principle also would contribute. And in the path integral, solutions with symmetry are particularly important. And that is because all of those solutions that have that are in the same symmetry equivalence class, all those solutions that differ only by the symmetry have the same action, and therefore they contribute the same to the path integral. Therefore, you have constructive interference. So symmetric solutions contribute disproportionately much to the quantum path integral. So before we launch into symmetry, let us remember how Killing vector fields came about, because they are the key ingredient in the study of symmetry. And you will now see how Killing vector fields are the infinitesimal generators of symmetry movement. And I will make those terms more clear, I hope. What is a generator? What is a symmetry group? What is a group vector? So two space-time described by, let's say somebody gives you two space-time. One is described by some differential manifold, differentiable manifold with some metric on it, and the other is described by some differentiable manifold with some metric on it, then they are isometric and therefore describe exactly the same thing, the same spacetime with the same phase, if there is a diffeomorphism from the one differentiable manifold into the other, such that the image of the metric of one is the metric of the other by default. So we say that the spacetime has a symmetry if we find such a diffeomorphism, if in both cases it's the same manifold. So if there is a map of the manifold into itself, a differentiable map of the manifold into itself that leaves the metric invariant, therefore leaves the shape invariant, then we say that we have a symmetry. For example, we could have a spacetime that is like Fock time, and another one that's like Fock time. Then if they have the same shape, there's a difference, there's a diffeomorphism in between the two that maps the metric here to the metric there, that's the same. But you could also imagine choosing this to be the same manifold as that one, and then what we see is that we have a rotational symmetry. We have plenty of diffeomorphisms that map this can into that can in such a way that the metric is the same metric. And that will be, in this case, a continuous symmetry, because we can rotate by some degree, we can rotate by another degree, I mean by another angle,
and has a continuum of angles that we can rotate by. If this thing were not a round cylinder, but were, let's say, a cube, then we could have a discrete symmetry. We could rotate only by 90 degrees, for example. But in practice, most relevant are the continuums. So in this case, diffeomorphism phi forms a rotation of n about a symmetry axis. And so we then obtain that m tilde is m. And the metric goes into itself under the bulldog. As for the terminology, we will say that if you take this manifold and map it onto itself with varying angles, then any particular point P will undergo an orbit. It will be mapped this point to that point to that point to that point, depending on by how many degrees you're rotating. And you will say that the point P, therefore, moves on an orbit. You will say that P has an orbit under the axis of a symmetry group. Yes, one map, one rotation, one fixed amount of rotation.
Many maps together.
So I was using the term symmetry group. And I know that some of you are from math and some of you are from physics, and so I cannot assume that you all know that you all have the same background.
Let me just quickly say something about the notion of group so that we can then speak of symmetry group. Please remember, or hopefully, I hope you've seen that before, but just to make sure, a group G is a set with an operation that you may call little circle. It could be anything. You might, some occasions it might be denoted by a plus sign, some occasions by a multiplication symbol, some occasions by some completely different symbol, doesn't matter. So let's say we denote it by little circle. And that little circle map takes two elements of this set, maps them into another element of the set. And the set is supposed to contain an element E that will be called the neutral element. And the set is supposed to be composed of elements which, with respect to this operation, obey these axioms. Namely, associativity, meaning that they don't group. That's what associativity means, non-grouping. And E is to act as the neutral element from the left and from the right. And there's supposed to be an inverse element for every element of that set. Then the definition is that any set with an operation within circle and a neutral element such that these actions are obeyed is called a group. There are lots of groups out there, infinitely many, as you can imagine. And a certain type of group is called a Lie group. Namely, if the set in question consists of elements that obey these axioms, and the set is, on top of that, also a differentiable manifold, then such a group is called a Lie group. Just to repeat that, if the group elements not only obey the axioms of the group, but also form a finite dimensional smooth manifold, then it's a Lie group. For example, consider the set of translations in three-dimensional space. For every translation, there's an inverse translation that gets you back to where you started. Any two translations can be concatenated, can be performed one after the other, and this concatenation operation could be this little circle there. So if you take a translation in some direction and concatenate it with a translation in some other direction, you end up overall with a translation. So you take two translations, you get a third one. There's also a neutral element, which is the translation by zero, by no amount. And you can easily verify that associativity and neutrality hold. Same is true for rotation. Rotations form a group, can rotate by some angle, rotate by another angle, And overall, the whole thing is a rotation by some angle about a different axis. But it's a rotation nevertheless. Also, rotations are associative and have inverse. The neutral element being, of course, no rotation at all. Rotation by zero, by the angle zero. And those are going to be prototypes of what Killing vector fields are generalized. They're generalizing translation, and they're generalizing rotation, as we will see. Yes, I was just going to say that. The set of translations is parameterized in three dimensions, is parameterized by three numbers, namely the direction vector's component. We translate into this direction, this one. You have to specify three numbers. So every group element of the translation group in three dimensions is smoothly parameterized by three numbers. Okay? And that makes the group of translations in three dimensions a Lie group, because it makes it a differentiable manifold. It takes a little bit of abstraction to see that this is so, that group elements can also be points of a manifold. It's not complicated, it's just abstract. Similarly for rotation. You just have to specify, let's say, two angles, and that will give you a rotation. However, the set of angles doesn't form the same manifold as the set of translation stuff. While for the rotations, you get a manifold which is a sphere, for the translations in three dimensions, you simply get a manifold that is R3. It's isomorphic to R3. And generally, you can have quite a complicated structure for your manifold of a Lie group. And you will generalize those notions of the Lie group of translation, the Lie group of rotation, you will generalize to curve manifold. Okay, so in this sense, a point P has an orbit under the action of a symmetry Lie group. Now let's remember the Lie derivative, and let's remember quickly how we derive Killing vector fields. The Lie derivative was defined like that. Lie derivative in the direction of the vector field psi of some tensor is what you get when you take a tensor covariantly differentiated, and then contract with the direction vector. And then you contract covariant derivatives of the direction vector with the tensor in question. And the index structure is just such that you have the correct contraction with the contravariant and the covariant limit. Remember the meaning of the Lie derivative. The Lie derivative gives us the rate of change of the tensor Q along the flow of diffeomorphism phi generated by the vector field psi. Remember that the vector field psi generates diffeomorphism, generates a flow along the manifold, and the Lie derivative gives us the rate of change of a tensor under this flow, under the infinitesimal flow, in the direction we just start the flow there. So here we can use the Lie derivative now to differentiate along the symmetry group orbits, for example. So if we have a symmetry group, for example, translations of rotation of our manifold, then every point flows along the symmetry in some direction. And we can differentiate in particular the metric along that. And what we are saying is that we have a symmetry if the metric is not changing under that flow, which is to say that in particular, it's not changing also infinitesimally. It's also globally not changing, but also infinitesimally it's not. And that is, of course, the statement that the Lie derivative of the metric in the direction of the symmetry flow is vanishing. Remember that the covariant derivative of the metric is always vanishing. This is simply expressing the consistency between the affine connection and the metric description of the shape of the manifold. This is non-trivial. It does not always hold. if psi generates a symmetry flow, then we have that the lead derivative of the metric is vanishing in this direction. But the lead derivative is, according to the formula that we just had, the covariant derivative of a tensor, this piece contracted with the direction vector psi, the covariant derivative of the direction vector contracted with the tensor. Remember that this is exactly what we had here. The derivative of the tensor is covariant derivative of the tensor, in our case, the covariant derivative of the metric, vanishes, contracted with the direction vector, and then those terms here, where we differentiate the direction vector. So this term is vanishing, just the consistency between the affine and the metric description of the shape of the manifold. So we have the zero equal to this. We can use the metric to lower the index, and therefore the statement that the metric stays the same under the flow, the symmetry flow generated by psi, or in the direction of psi, is this statement here, which is of course the condition for a Killing vector field. Psi is a Killing vector field of this pole, which is the same thing as this pole. How many Killing vector fields can we possibly have on space-time? What's the maximum number? The answer is 10. And how does that come about? Well, in order to obey this equation here, Killing vector field psi may simply have the property that this thing then. Never mind the anti-symmetry in this. It might just be that this thing itself vanishes, which is to say that the covariant derivative of psi is vanishing. And what does that mean? Well, there can only be four solutions to that, because at every point, there are only four linearly independent vectors. So the maximum number of solutions to this equation here is 4. On the other hand, this equation can also hold when these guys are not zero. In this case, this thing viewed as a matrix, which we may call K mu nu. K mu nu is psi mu semicolon nu. This matrix has to be anti-symmetric. That's what this equation says, the Killing vector field equation. But then this K mu nu is a 4x4 matrix that's anti-symmetric. How many entries can it have? 4x4 matrix, anti-symmetric, where the diagonal is zero. And then it has 6 off-diagonals above the diagonal, and 6 below the diagonal, but because of the anti-symmetry, they are related, so overall you have 6. So at most, you can have 6 Killing vector fields that obey that equation by virtue of being anti-symmetric. Now, the Killing vector fields are doing what is called generating the Lie group. And the idea here is that the Lie group consists of elements that describe finite symmetry transformations, a rotation by an angle of 32 degrees. And a Lie algebra is the infinitesimal version of a Lie group. The Killing vector fields point into the direction of a diffeomorphism flow, of a symmetry flow. The Killing vector fields are infinitesimal versions of a group element. And as such, they are elements of not a Lie group, but a Lie algebra. How exactly that comes about, I'll show you in a moment. Now, maybe I'll give you a little indication of this. Consider, for example, the translation group. For the translation group, the infinitesimal generators are d by dxi. And they are the infinitesimal generators because e to the power of A D by D X I of F of F of X 1, X 2, X 3, this is all happening in R 3, just giving you a very, very simple example, is F of X 1 plus A 1 plus X 2 plus A 2 plus X 3 plus A 3, comma, sorry, X 1 plus A 1, comma, X 2 plus A 2, comma, X 3 plus A 3. And this is simply Taylor's theorem. This is the Taylor expansion. So what you see here is that this is the action of a group element we are translating by the amount A1, A2, A3, which is a group element. And we're generating this by a linear combination of those vector fields, D by DXI. And the killing vector fields are, of course, of that kind. That's just the R3 translation special case motivation. What is a Lie algebra? The killing vector fields will be elements of a Lie algebra, not of a Lie group, of the symmetry Lie group, but of the symmetry Lie algebra. So what is a Lie algebra? A Lie algebra is a vector space, let's call it A, with an operation that is usually denoted by a curly bracket, but it could also be a square bracket. Doesn't matter. We could also denote this thing by a little circle or whatever, right? It doesn't matter at all. So a Lie algebra is a vector space A with an operation that maps elements, two elements of our vector space into another element of the vector space. This operation is called the Lie bracket. And the operation has to obey anti-symmetry and the Jacobi identity. Any vector space equipped with an operation that obeys these axioms is called a Lie algebra. And the killing vector fields will be just a special case. Yep.
Vector spaces or arbitrary groups?
Oh, there's no group involved in this.
Okay.
Absolutely no group involved, just any vector space here. And you will see that there is a connection to the groups, but for the moment, this thing can stand alone. Now the set of killing vector fields forms a Lie algebra. And this is what will support the claim that the infinitesimal version of a Lie group, in our case, the symmetry Lie groups, have the infinitesimal as infinitesimal versions the killing vector fields, because they are differentiated in the direction of the flow, just like those guys. And in fact, they will be recognized very soon as special examples of what we're talking about. So the claim now is that the killing vector fields of a particular space-time form a Lie algebra. Now, I'm not going to go through the proof. I leave it up to you to check that. I just point out what you have to check for that purpose. Really straightforward. What you have to show is that if psi 1 and psi 2 are killing vector fields of the same manifold, then any linear combination of the two of them is also a killing vector field. Right. And you know what is the defining equation of the killing vector fields, this equation that we had up there. All you have to show is that if psi 1 obeys the equation, psi 2 obeys the equation, any linear combination will be true. So that shows that we have the vector space. And then you also have to show that the bracket, which is defined as the commutator of vector fields. Remember that what a vector field does, killing vector fields are vector fields after all. They map functions to functions. They map zero forms into zero forms. So you apply psi 1 on a function, you get another function. And you apply psi 2 to it, you get another function. What if you did it the other way around, like the difference? What you get is
some other function. And that is what is, by definition, psi 1, psi 2. What needs to be shown is that this is a vector field, if it is defined in this way, and no more than that, that it's a killing vector field. And finally, it needs to be shown that the so defined Lie bracket obeys the Jacobi identity. So here is the big picture. So let us assume this as verified. So here's the big picture then. The symmetries of a space-time form a group. If you can rotate it by 23 degrees, and then let's say we have those two cans, or it's just one can, of course, and we just map the manifold into itself. The second picture is also. Then we can rotate by 3 degrees, by 7 degrees, and by 90 degrees, whatever we like. And we can verify that this, that the composition of such rotations is having always an inverse, and it's associative, that there's a neutral element, and so on. So we have a symmetry group. And it's a continuous group, in fact, a differentiable group, so it is a Lie group. The symmetries are differentiably parameterized by the flow, in this case, by the angle, for example, in the simplest case. But if it were, if the manifold is simply R3, then the symmetry group would be, well, you would have several symmetry groups. You would have the symmetry group of translation, which is itself isomorphic to R3, because translations are parameterized by the three parameters of in which direction we translate. But also, we would have the symmetry group of the rotation. Mm-hmm. So the conclusion, first of all, is that the symmetries form a Lie group. Not always, but in the cases that we consider. You could have a manifold which is like a cube. Then the symmetry group, there is a finite symmetry group, but it's only discrete symmetry. Mm-hmm. Then each killing vector field, we know, is the infinitesimal generator of a flow of isometric isomorphism, that is, of a symmetry. Killing vector field is always pointing in the direction of the symmetry flow. And so we have seen here that the killing vector fields form indeed a Lie algebra, a symmetry Lie algebra. So the symmetries themselves are elements of a Lie group, a symmetry Lie group. The killing vector fields, however, are elements of a symmetry Lie algebra. One can, in fact, show, but we will not do this here, it's a piece of pure mathematics, that every Lie algebra generates a Lie group. In this case, we started with a Lie group, its flow, and its infinitesimal flow, the derivative in the direction of the flow, gave us a Lie algebra. But you can go the other way around. You can start with a Lie algebra and just make up on your own a Lie algebra by starting with a vector space and giving it a Lie algebra brackets that obey the axioms. And then from that, you can actually generate a group. For example, you could take those guys. They form a Lie algebra. Pretty simple, because totally commutative, all the Lie brackets are zero. But still, it's, they form a three-dimensional, just the derivatives, they form a three-dimensional Lie algebra. And the group that they generate is the group of translation. Mm-hmm. But how does all of this abstract stuff look like in practice? Well, before that, we do some more definition. Let's define what we mean by the surface of homogeneity and the isotropy subgroup. Roughly speaking, those guys are associated with translation, and those guys with rotation. But it will be a much more general notion. And so we need a more general expression. Here's the first effect. Let us consider the dimension of the Lie algebra, which is also the dimension of the Lie group. Because for every direction of the Lie group, we have a Lie algebra element. So the dimension of the manifold of the Lie group is always the dimension of the vector space of the Lie algebra. And let us call this dimension R. So in R3, R would be 3. then next definition, consider the set of points orbit. Let's consider the set of points O of P that the point P of the manifold can flow to along the Killing vector field, along the flow, along the symmetry. Then this O of P is called the orbit of under the action of the symmetry group. So when we looked at the example of just the hook cap and the symmetry group being just the rotation, then the orbit that a point would undergo under rotation was a one-dimensional line. And therefore, it was perhaps intuitive to call this an orbit, because the orbit of a satellite also is, you know, a one-dimensional line. But according to this definition, we have to widen our understanding of this now, because the orbit of the point is the set of all points that P can be mapped into by the action of the symmetry group.
In the case of the canyon, but look at, for example, R3 and the translation rule. Now, what can an individual point be mapped into? What is the set of images of a fixed point P under the translation rule? Well, you can get it everywhere, right?
So the orbit of a point in R3 under the action of the translation group is the entire R3. So don't think of an orbit as always being just a one-dimensional line. It is the set of images of a point under this full symmetry group.
P3
under. Yes, R would be 3, and that dimension would be 3 as well. So. Now, one might think that the dimension of the orbit is always the dimension of the symmetry group.
After all, in the case of the can, the symmetry group was one dimensional, just the angle, and the orbit was one dimensional. In the case of R3, the symmetry group was three-dimensional, and the orbit was three-dimensional. But that's not generally so. We can easily have a situation where the dimension of the orbit is smaller than the dimension of the symmetry leak group. Here's an example. Consider, for example, the flat R2, just the plane. And let's look at the point P at the origin. Then, what is the dimension of the symmetry group? Well, it's n times n plus 1/2 equal to 3. Actually, I should have shown that to you. I don't know, the very beginning somewhere. Yes. Here we go. Remember, I asked how many Killing vector fields can you possibly have in space-time? And the number is 10. But actually, if space-time was not 10, was not 3 plus 1 dimensional, it's 4 dimensional, but have some other dimension n, the general formula is that the number of Killing vector fields is n times n plus 1/2. By the same reasoning that we came to the 10 here, namely 4 dimensions, because at every point there are 4 independent directions, this is how you can achieve that state individually, right? And then you have an anti-symmetric 2 tensor, and you can ask how many independent components it has. If you add the 2 up, you always get n times n plus 1/2 as the maximum number of Killing vector fields. And in the case of the dimension being 4, this is 10. Namely, 4 times 5 is 20 over 2 is 10. Okay. So now we were looking at the case of R2. Yep. Now we are looking at the case of our flat R2 and to some point. Then flat R2 has the maximum number of symmetries, obviously. So how many Killing vector fields do we expect? Well, n times n plus 1/2. N times n plus 1/2, so it's 2 times 3, half is 3. Yep.
Those just correspond to the translation along one direction, along the other, and then rotation. So those be 3?
Correct. That's what's going to be. That's right. So the three-dimensional V algebra So the number 3 is the dimension of the symmetry U. The number 3 is, of course, then also the dimension of the Lie algebra. Lie algebra is a vector space, as such, it has dimension 3.
And concretely, here are those 3 Killing vector fields. Namely, in R2, we have translations in the x direction, and they are generated in exactly this way by Taylor's theorem. If you exponentiate d by dx, you get a translation in the x direction. If you exponentiate d by dy, you get a translation in the y direction. And if you exponentiate this, which is the exponentiation of the angular momentum, this is, if you know quantum mechanics, Lz, it's the third component of the angular momentum, and you get a rotation. But we don't have to appeal to quantum mechanics. We can simply take this on mathematical grounds. What we have to verify only is that the condition for Killing vector fields is obeyed. And it will be. Those two cases give us that the Killing vector field equation is obeyed because each of the two terms is vanishing. And in this case, we have that the antisymmetry is obeyed. So what then is the orbit of our point? Well, it's going to be R2, all of R2, just by the same reasoning that we had just a minute ago where we said in the case of R3, the orbit will be that. Even if we considered only translation. In this case, for R2, we even wrote down all the Killing vector fields, not just the translation, but also the rotation. So this is the these are generating the full symmetry group of translation and rotation.
B bracket is just going to be the commutator?
Yes.
Is it, when do you have it that it's not just the commutator?
Well, abstractly, you can define the Lie algebra and have a Lie bracket that is nowhere represented. It's just an abstract structure, for example. And then you can have it represented in different ways. I mean, for example, in classical mechanics, you have the Poisson bracket. Have you heard of the Poisson bracket? Everybody? Poisson bracket? Okay. Now, what is a Poisson algebra? A Poisson algebra is a Lie algebra and an associative algebra. You see, if you, in classical mechanics, you have variables qi and pj. And you can multiply them and add them. You can write down something like q1 squared p3 to the 4 minus 4. And that's a valid expression because there is a multiplication in between them, which is associative. It's just the usual sort of associative algebra. But on top of that, you also have here a Lie bracket defined on the algebra of Q's and P's. A Lie bracket which obeys Q_i Lie bracket with Pj equal delta ij. Right? That's a Poisson bracket. So what we have in classical mechanics is an algebra which is both an associative algebra with respect to a multiplication and a Lie algebra with respect to such a bracket. Now this bracket in classical mechanics is clearly not the commutator. Because if we write down the commutator, qi pj minus pj qi is zero in classical mechanics. Instead, in classical mechanics, this Poisson bracket is usually, well, in principle, you don't ever have to represent it as a commutator or as anything else. But if you do want to represent it as something, then you can represent it d by dqi, d by dpi minus, so what we have is the Lie bracket, which in this case is called the Poisson bracket, because the algebra is both the Lie algebra and the associative algebra. You know that this is ds by dqi dg by dpi minus df by dpi dg by dqi sum over I. Okay? That's not a commutator. That's not the commutator between f and g. And by the way, that's a very important thing. When I teach quantum mechanics, what I do is I introduce this Poisson algebra of the Qs and the Ps. And then, you see, once you understood this piece, it's very easy to go to quantum mechanics from here. Because in quantum mechanics, this is still true. Please don't think that there's going to be an IH bar in this. Because in quantum mechanics, it's still true that the Poisson bracket, or the D bracket between Q and P, has just ones or zeros on the right. What changes in quantum mechanics is that the commutator is no longer equal to zero, but the commutator is IH bar delta IJ, which means that in quantum mechanics, this is no longer valid. It can no longer represent F and Z, the D bracket between F and Z, using those derivatives. For one thing, F and G are no longer functions, but you could differentiate with respect to Q and P. Right? F and G are polynomials in Q and P which are operators. This wouldn't even make sense. But instead, what you can now do in quantum mechanics is that you can say that the commutator of Qi Pj gives you a representation of this. You see, this whole representation of classical mechanics fails in quantum mechanics. But you gain a new representation. Namely, you gain that the Poisson bracket of Qi and Pj is equal to 1 over IH bar. And you see that this representation as a commutator is singular. It breaks down when H bar goes to 0. And then we have to switch to this one. But you see, what we see here is the following, the message I want to convey, which has nothing to do with our course, okay? The message is the following, and that is really the deep insight of Paul Dirac, 1930, and still it's not so well known as it should be. The key message is this, that in classical mechanics, we have a Poisson algebra, where this is the fundamental Lie bracket, and where the commutativity of Q and P is the fundamental associative commutation relation. And in quantum mechanics, we have the same Lie bracket with the other Jacobi identity and everything. And we have only that this changes by IH bar over there, the commutator. That's the only thing that changes. Now, why does quantum mechanics look so different from classical mechanics? It looks so different because the representation theories are different. As long as we work with classical quantum mechanics, the Lie bracket is represented in this way, and the F and the G are simply differentiable functions of Q and P. So there's no Hilbert space, there's nothing of that kind. But the moment we make this non-commutative, this representation breaks down, and this becomes a valid representation. So the representation theory is completely different in classical mechanics as it is in quantum mechanics. But abstractly, there's not much of a change, because the Lie algebra and the associative algebra stay nearly the same. The Lie algebra stays the same. The associative algebra just picks up this IH bar over there. And it's only, they only look so different because the representation theories are so different. I think that's a very deep insight of Dirac, that most of the difference between classical and quantum mechanics is representation theoretical, and not deep. Because deeply, as the Poisson algebra, they are virtually the same. Anyway, that was off on a tangent there. Okay. So we had those in the case of R2. We have maximally three Keeling vector fields. And here's the basis of those three Keeling vector fields. Remember that any linear combination of the two is a Keeling vector field. So therefore, that's just a random choice of those three. We could choose any other linear combination, linear combinations of those three, and could use them as the basis
in the vector space of feeling vector fields. Because after all, we've shown, or I've assumed you in an exercise showed, that feeling vector fields form a Lie algebra, which means that, in particular, they form a vector space. Anyway, so what is the orbit? The orbit of a point is R2, because any point can be reached by translation and rotation. Even translations alone would suffice. But that means that the dimension of the orbit is two, right? The point P gets mapped into any one of the two-dimensional set of points. But the dimension of the Lie algebra is 3. The dimension of the symmetry Lie group is 3. So here we have an example of S being 2 and R being 3. R being the dimension of the symmetry group, S being the dimension of the orbit. Here the dimension of the orbit is 1 lower than the dimension of the symmetry group. So what we say here is that the surface part, homogeneity, has dimension S equal to 2. The surface of homogeneity is the set of all points that the point P can be mapped into. It's the orbit of that point. We have that out somewhere before. Here, okay. Right. So this is the surface of infinity. By the way, even though this is something that is potentially a source of confusion, so let me just clarify this up before. We have here 3 Killing vector fields, and they are obviously very different. You cannot get this one as a linear combination of those two, right? Cannot. Or cannot get this one as a linear combination of this, right? Well, not as fields, but at every point you can. Because remember that at every point, the tangent space is only two-dimensional. So this thing is pointing in some direction, that thing is pointing in some direction, this is pointing in some direction, they have to be linearly dependent of another. At every point of the manifold, you can always have only n linearly independent Killing vector fields at most, where n is the dimension of the manifold. It doesn't mean, though, that overall the number of Killing vector fields is limited by the dimension of the manifold. I mean, after all, the dimension of the set of all vector fields is infinite. You could have 20. Well, we know Killing vector fields, there can't be more than n times n plus 1 half. But that can definitely be much bigger than. Okay. So what is the role now of K3? Remember that K1 and K2 are translations in the x direction, translations in the y direction. K3, I gave it away already. So the flow generated by K3 leaves the point P fixed and rotates everything around P. We know that from quantum mechanics, for example. This is what this flow is doing. I mean, you can appeal to the quantum mechanics, but you can also go back and ask, here we have the Killing vector field, what are its integral terms? What is the flow that it generates, right? We have equations, differential equations. For every vector field, you can calculate what flow it generates. If you do that for the K3, and you draw the flow that you get, then it's going to be this. So we don't have to appeal for quantum mechanics for this. We have all the tools there to derive. Okay, so the flow generated by K3 leaves the point P fixed and rotates everything about it. So we see that Killing vector fields can do two different kinds of things. They can, in essence, translate or rotate. But of course, we will want to be able to handle more than just R2 and R3. So we don't speak of translations and rotation. Instead, we say that those Killing vector fields which do not generate a homogeneity surface, which is to say, which do not generate an orbit, those are said to be generating an isotropy subgroup. So our K3 is generating an isotropy subgroup. It's generating not the full symmetry group, just a subgroup, and it is called an isotropy subgroup. An isotropy subgroup is a symmetry that is not moving our point. It's just rotating stuff, no translation. So the translations give us the homogeneity surface, which is the orbit, and the isotropy subgroup leaves the point the same and just rotates stuff around it. So then what is the dimension of the isotropy subgroup? Well, there is R, the dimension of the symmetry group, which is also the dimension of the Lie algebra viewed as a vector. Then we subtract the dimension of the orbit, and we obtain the remaining dimensions are those of the isotropy by definition. Okay, so the symmetry group has some number of dimensions. In the case of R2, the number of dimensions was 3, because we had translation X, translation Y, and rotation. In R2, that's just one angle. So we had 3 dimensions here for the full symmetry group, and for the full Lie algebra, symmetry Lie algebra, 3 dimensions. And the surface of homogeneity, which is to say the orbit, had dimension 2, because it was R2, every point could be reached by translation. It was 2, so we had 3, minus 2 is 1, and indeed we have a one-dimensional isotropy subgroup, which is the symmetry group of rotation, 1. So this is all the abstract stuff that I illustrated with R2 and R3, but we did it abstractly enough that we can do this now for cosmological models. But the idea is, it's hard to solve the Einstein equation, but if we assume symmetry, then we should be able to do it. We won't go into the actual calculations, I just give you the starting point in the end. So the classification of cosmological models can be done with respect to how much symmetry of what kind we assume. How much symmetry do we assume of the translational kind? So how much symmetry, how much, what dimension do we assume for the orbit, for symmetry orbit? And how many dimensions do we assume for the isotropy subgroup? How much translation invariance, how much rotation invariance? So let's look, for example, at the isotropy subgroup and its dimension d. Remember, over here, this equation, d is the dimension of the isotropy subgroup, r is the dimension of the full symmetry group, s is the dimension, is the number of homogeneous dimensions. So if we have absolutely no isotropy subgroup, if we have no isotropic symmetry, which means we have no rotational symmetry at all, d is equal to 0. That is what is called the n-isotropic case, and of course, in nature, that's what we have, strictly speaking. Not everything looks the same all the rest. We could also have, we could also assume to have just one axis of symmetry, for example, where we have one angle, a one-dimensional isotropy subgroup, or 2 or 3 or 4, up to 6, because this is not just about rotations, it's also about boosts. Rotations in space-time, in general, are Lorentz transformations, and there are up to 6 of them. So, more generally, if we don't want to be restricted, of course, to Minkowski space, remember our discussion above, the maximum number of filling vector fields is 10, 4 of the homogeneous type, and 6 of the type where it's an anti-symmetric matrix, and that's the isotropic. So So for example, if we assume, as is very popular in cosmology, that we have, with a very good approximation, three spatial symmetry directions, so that the universe is assumed to look the same virtually in all directions in space, then you would have an isotropy subgroup assumption of dimension three. In Minkowski space, we would have six for the Pauling symmetry. The dimension of the homogeneity surfaces, the dimension of the orbits, therefore, where we could have absolutely no translation invariant, no translation, no inhomogeneous symmetry, it would be the case of zero. If we assume spatial symmetry, spatial translational symmetry, then we would have three as the dimension of the homogeneity surfaces. And if things were also the same in time, if we had also time translation, then we could have up to four. And of course, in cosmology, that's unlikely to be right. So if we try to solve the Einstein equation with symmetry assumptions, then those symmetry assumptions can be described by two numbers. How many dimensions for the isotropy subgroup, and how many dimensions for the surfaces of homogeneity? Roughly speaking, rotations and boosts and translation in space and time. Many exact solutions are known for various combinations of D and S, D ranging up to 6, S and 4. And more than that, not only exact solutions are known, sometimes the exact solution may not be obtainable, but it may be possible to still deduce the asymptotic behavior at early times, for example, of solutions that have particular values of D and S. A comprehensive textbook on these studies is, for example, the text by Wainwright and Ellis, which appeared some 10 years ago. And John Wainwright was, by the way, up until recently the chairman of our department, the Applied Math Department. So for sure the library has no book. Okay. Here's some examples. If the homogeneity surfaces are assumed to have these dimensions, and the isotropy subgroups are assumed to have those dimensions, then the solutions are known which have these names. For example, Einstein's static model, can tell them that not to be static, but four dimensions in the homogeneity surfaces, which means latent time. And then, of particular importance, are going to be those things, of course, the three fundamental models, which have three-dimensional homogeneity surfaces, which is to say, three spatial translation symmetries, and a three-dimensional isotropy subgroup, which is to say that we have fully three-dimensional rotational symmetry. But as you can see here, there are also solutions which have less symmetry, which I think is remarkable that, you know, the less symmetry you have, the harder it is to solve the actual question. Other than assumptions on symmetry, assumptions are also made, the way we just did, assumptions are also being made about the energy momentum case, obviously. And that leads to a further subdivision of cases. And I can only give you here an overview of what the literature has. And this analysis, the study of energy momentum tensor in the cosmological context, starts with the following proposition that you won't prove here, namely that every physical energy momentum tensor TMU, which means every energy momentum tensor that can be obtained using the
fields that we now know exist in nature. Every such as momentum tensor that exists, a time-like vector field U, such that the energy momentum tensor can be put into this form. This is not quite the form for a perfect fluid. It's much more general than that, but every energy momentum tensor for any sort of matter and radiation can be put into this form. There will be some vector field U which is time-like, such that this is a representation of the energy momentum tensor. And more than that, we can require that the Q and pi, these coefficients Q here, and this thing, this tensor pi, operate those equations. As a proof of that proposition, you can find, for example, the text by Hawking. Same values, by the way. This vector field U is called the fundamental for velocity field. But in general, this U doesn't need to have anything to do with velocity. For example, you could have a universe in which there's only electromagnetic fields. And then the U is not the velocity of some fluid. So for example, for a perfect fluid, we considered that case before, perfect fluid would be, for example, dust. You would have this energy momentum tensor, which is a special case of the energy momentum tensor that we talked about. And this energy momentum tensor, this form applies to dust, which can be called perfect fluid, but it happens so that this energy momentum tensor, the simplified form of the energy momentum tensor, also applies to the case of radiation and to the case of the cosmological constant. This energy momentum tensor has only two parameters, mu, which is the energy density, and just choose the u since it's time-like. You can always choose a coordinate system in which this thing is just non-zero in the zero component, and then zero in the spatial component. It's a time-like vector, the u, right? And if you choose that coordinate system, you see that mu is the t00 component, and p
gives you the ii component. Therefore, mu is the energy density, and p is the pressure. Remember, we defined the so-called equation of state, which is the relationship between the pressure and the energy density. And let me just remind you that in the case of dust, and dust could be consisting of grains as big as a galaxy, in the case of dust, we have energy density, all right, but no pressure, because those galaxies are not supposed to bound into each other. So in that case, this parameter gamma here is 1, this bracket is 0, and the pressure is 0. We only have energy density, but no pressure, so it's really perfect. In the case of radiation, shortly after the Big Bang, the universe was radiation dominated, as we will discuss in more detail Thursday. Now we have a factor of 4/3 here, and that means that we have, along with the positive energy density, we also have a positive pressure density. A positive pressure is just a third of the energy density. In the case of the cosmological constant, if the universe was dominated by the cosmological constant, which apparently it now is, then we have the gamma equal to 0, and the pressure is just minus energy density in suitable units. Yes, that was just a reminder. And here's a definition that you may find in the literature if you look into studies of cosmological solutions. If we have a space-time which has a space-like three-dimensional homogeneity surface, so we have three-dimensional translation symmetry, But the fundamental velocity vector that we had above is not orthogonal to the homogeneity surfaces, then we say that this monoid is tilted. We're not expecting this to be the case in Nectar, but it is definitely a possibility, namely that we have translational symmetry. And yet, the energy momentum tensor, the energy momentum tensor, which can always be put into this form with some suitable vector field U, may have a vector field U here, which is not orthogonal to those surfaces of homogeneity. And if that's happening, then lots of strange things are happening. In particular, you then have the nonlinearities of the Einstein equation kick in, and you could have that for a while the space-time looks as if it was well-behaved and everything is just very smooth and symmetric, and then the nonlinearities just make the thing totally go off the rails, and then maybe back after a while. You see, in general relativity, it's generally hard to claim that because something is small, it's just a small perturbation. And that's because it's a nonlinear theory. And so even small things can build up to something large. And this is one of the circumstances where that likes to happen. Okay, we continue with the classification of exact solutions. A systematic classification of the energy momentum tensor can be done and is very helpful in understanding what's going on in cosmology. And it is inviting for that purpose to look at the energy momentum tensor to say, well, it's symmetric after all. And when we have a symmetric matrix, we can quickly say something interesting about it by diagonalizing. Symmetric matrix, summation, has eigenvalues, and the eigenvalues don't even depend on the choice of basis. So they surely mean something, one would think. That's the idea behind this degree classification. However, that's not quite so easy as it may sound. The reason is that even though TMU is symmetric, the vector space in which this is a symmetric operator or symmetric matrix has a non-trivial inner product. You see, the inner product in the vector space here is the inner product with respect to the metric. But the metric is not positive definite. Even if you choose a frame, you have this minus sign in there. So that means that T mu nu is, strictly speaking, not Hermitian. Now, okay, we might say, well, we can get around this. All we have to do is we have to raise one of those indices. Because when we raise the index here and we compare it with the metric, you see, when in the metric you raise one index, it just becomes the Kronecker delta. So then we are safe. The inner product in our vector space is just the Kronecker delta. It's just the usual thing in a vector space. And therefore, we should be in business. We can just diagonalize this thing and get real eigenvalues. Well, no, not so tricky, because at the moment we raise this index, this thing doesn't have to be symmetric anymore. So it's slipping out of our hands again. So what we have to do here is we cannot use the fact that symmetric operators have a unique diagonalization with the real eigenvalues. Instead, we have to remember from linear algebra that nevertheless, any matrix has a Jordan normal form. So instead of simply diagonalizing this thing, we have to bring it in the Jordan normal form, which has those, you know, if you remember this upper triangle and on the upper triangular stuff on top of the diagonal. Which one? This one? Oh, that isn't.
No, it's symmetric, but it's not Hermitian because the vector space in which it lives has an inner product. So the Segre classification does that. you go and actually decompose this into the journal global form, and then you get properties of TMU that are basis independent and therefore physical relevant. And you can classify your energy momentum tensors in this way, and you get four main types of energy momentum tensors. And then, of course, once you have a classification of energy momentum tensors, then
this gives you via the Einstein equation a classification of the Ricci tensor, because they're clearly very closely related. All right, so now we have a way of, at least we have a strategy, and it has been performed in the literature in the past, for classifying the energy momentum tensor, which is the same as classifying the Ricci tensor. And you're not going to go into the details of that. But we have, but you know how it works, right? You just take the Donner normal form and then read off what structure it has, and that's the basis independent structure, and that we can use for the classification of mu, which is the same as the classification of the army. But now remember that army mu has 10 degrees of freedom. The full Riemann tensor has 20. And what are the missing 10? Missing 10 are in the Weyl tensor. Remember this C tensor? And it describes homogeneous gravity, gravity that would be there even if there's no matter. The, remember that the Weyl tensor doesn't occur in the Einstein equation. For example, gravitational waves would fall into that category. Just like, but not only gravitational waves. For example, look at the gravitational field of the sun outside the sun in vacuum. Space is curved there, but not because there is matter there. It's curved because there is matter elsewhere, where the sun is. Just like with electromagnetic fields. You could have a solid with lots of charges and current in it. And then there are going to be electromagnetic fields in it as well, of course. But outside of that solid, you also have electromagnetic fields. They would be of the homogeneous type. Even if they are not traveling waves, they are still a homogeneous solution. Yep.
There's an analogy of the Weyl tensor for the electromagnetic tensor.
Yes, that's right. The Weyl tensor is, in essence, describing the degrees of freedom of the homogeneous electromagnetism of just the electromagnetic waves. So the Weyl tensor describes the gravitational waves. And just like in electromagnetism, you have homogeneous solutions that are not necessarily traveling waves. Also in gravity, you have homogeneous solutions that are not necessarily traveling waves. You may be familiar with antenna physics a little bit. When you have an antenna, you have a charges shooting up and down, and they will create alternatingly an electric field that goes this way, and then an electric field that goes that way, and of course magnetic fields that go that way, and then this way, and so on. Right? So they will create electrostatic and magnetostatic fields that are not really static because they are changing all the time. And they're pretty strong, close to the antenna. They are what is called the near field. Those electric fields and those magnetic fields live in the vacuum. So they are solutions to the Maxwell equations, where on the right hand side there are no charges or current at this point, right? So they are homogeneous solutions. But they are not traveling, they are not going very far. They're very strong, but they're not going very far. They decay faster, their energy decays faster than 1/r. And but also those changing electric fields, changing magnetic fields, induce changing electric and magnetic fields, and they then turn into traveling waves. So near to an antenna, you have the waves that travel, and on top of that, you also have the near field, electromagnetic near field. And gravity is similar. You have the gravitational near field, and then further away, they have decayed, and you're left only with the gravitational waves. But both the near field and the gravitational waves are vacuum solutions, just like the electromagnetism. The near field close to the antenna is a vacuum solution. because where you are looking at the state, it is direct. In this way, it's very simple. But I'll say more about that in a moment.
All right, so what we said is that classifying the anti-momentum tensors is classifying the army new, but there are more degrees of freedom, namely those of the Weyl tensor. So we need to do a classification of the Weyl tensor as well. And while the Segre classification was looking at classifying the army new, the Petrov classification was classifying the Weyl tensor. Remember that the Weyl tensor has the same symmetry as the Riemann tensor. So it is anti-symmetric in mu nu and in rho f. So if we bring those two indices down, then we can swap those two for those two. So we can view the Weyl tensor as a matrix with double indices, where those two form one index and those two, one store down, also form one index. And we have an anti-symmetry there. And therefore, well, actually, while this is true, what I just said, it's also true that we have anti-symmetry here and we have anti-symmetry in dough. And that's what it is. Sorry. Okay. So we have anti-symmetry in mu and nu, and we have anti-symmetry in rho and epsilon. So therefore, we can view this, the right tensor, also as a map where we take a anti-symmetric contravariant two tensor, multiplied over here, contract with those two, and then get another anti-symmetric contravariant two tensor out of it. So we can say that the Weyl tensor can be viewed locally as a symmetric map from the anti-symmetric part of the contravariant two tensor to the symmetric part of the covariant two tensor. And they're also called bivectors. So you see how that works? You take a anti-symmetric tensor, anti-symmetric contravariant two tensor. So it's a tensor that has two upper indices and it's anti-symmetric in the two. If you contract that with those two indices, you end up with another anti-symmetric two tensor that is twofold, contravariant. Right. And it is symmetric, sorry, I said anti-symmetric. It is symmetric in the interchange of those two. You swap the mu nu with the rho epsilon, it's symmetric. So it seems that we are in the position that we can diagonalize this thing because it's a matrix that is symmetric that's mapping anti-symmetric covariant two tensors into anti-symmetric covariant two tensors. However, trapped again because the inner product in that space is again non-trivial just induced by the matrix because we're dealing with two upper indices rather than an upper and a lower index. And therefore, same story, C is generally non-permission, and the result is that we now have four main Petrov classes. I mean, I'm doing this here now for 3+1 dimensional space. Just like in the Segre classification, we got four because it was just happening in four dimensions. Here we're doing anything with two indices, anti-symmetric, that gives us 6 degrees of freedom, and therefore six main Petrov classes in which you can put the Weyl curvature tensor according to its eigenvalue, eigenvector decomposition, or really Jordan normal form. And here are the main types of Weyl curvature that can occur, just on the basis of this simple classification. The type O is the case where the Weyl curvature simply vanishes. That's easy. Then type D is the case where we have static Weyl curvature. For example, in the vicinity of a star. This is the case that corresponds to electromagnetism, for example, to the electrostatic field around the charge. The electrostatic field around the charge is a vacuum solution of the Maxwell equation. Of course, where the charge is sitting, there, it's an inhomogeneous case. But everywhere outside the charge, the solution is a vacuum solution. And therefore corresponds to a Weyl solution in the analogy with gravity. And you know that the static fields decay relatively quickly, whereas electromagnetic waves propagate much further. Then the type N is transverse gravitational waves. And these are really the traveling gravitational waves that are of interest. For example, the LIGO detector, gravitational wave detector, aims to detect those guys. Transverse gravitational waves described by the Weyl curvature. And just like the case of light, their strength decays like 1 over r, not like 1 over r squared. And that's because essentially, similar to electromagnetism, where electric fields that decay generate a magnetic field, and once they decay, they generate an electric field, it's similar with gravity, where you can also define an analog of gravitoelectric fields and gravitomagnetic fields, which have nothing to do with electric and magnetic fields. It's just that they are components of gravity which behave the way that electric fields would and generate when they decay magnetic fields and so on. It's just that you can disentangle the gravitational degrees of freedom in a similar way to how you can do it in electromagnetism, and so the same languages. And that is what makes them so decay. And that the one type of field generates the other when it decays, and therefore has this traveling wave. Well, and then there's the type I, or 1, longitudinal non-gravitational wave. These waves cause a shear effect, you know, like that. However, they decay fast, like 1 over r squared, so we are not going to see them in detectors. Even if a supernova generates them, you won't see them. And the reason is that, I mean, why do they decay so quickly? There's an intuition for that. Essentially, it is that, you know, when you have a, basically, these are waves that travel away from the source doing something like this. They shear the space-time. But gravitational waves are in a linear approximation. They behave just like electromagnetic waves that are massless. And therefore, small gravitational waves behaving just like massless electromagnetic fields propagate with the speed of light. And waves that propagate with the speed of light cannot have longitudinal degrees of freedom. They can only oscillate transversely, just like electrons have transversal spin degrees of freedom and longitudinal as well. But neutrinos that have no mass, I mean, maybe they have mass, but if neutrinos had no mass, then they could not have a longitudinal degree of freedom, longitudinal spin degree of freedom. Well, and then there are mixed types, of course. Type 3 would be, type 2 and 3 would be just mixed types of thereby. Okay, so rather than giving you the examples of how those solutions look like, let us just discuss what comes out of it at the end of the day. Namely, for the question of cosmic singularities, for example. What would the Big Bang have looked like? Well, let us assume a set of symmetries of matter and space-time have been chosen. So some homogeneity surface, some isotropy subgroup. And then let's assume that people have done the work and calculated the exact solution, or at least its asymptotic properties at early times have been found. And then assume we can choose time-like congruence of geodesics. Remember what that means? You take a space-like hypersurface, and then you look at geodesics that run at orthogonal angles to that space-like hypersurface. So you can look at either a congruence of geodesics, or you can look at fundamental velocity field that comes with the energy momentum tensor, and in many cases they actually coincide with another. In other cases they don't, for example when you have tilted solutions. once we have that, once we have the solution for at least the asymptotic behavior, we can then explicitly calculate the quantities that we considered abstractly on last Thursday. And we can then calculate explicitly the twist, the shear, and the expansion along the congruent. So we can calculate what neighboring geodesics are doing. Are they going to spin around another? Are they going to go closer to another? If you have geodesics that form a square, what is going to happen to the square? Or let's say they form geodesics that run through a circle. Is that circle going to turn into an ellipse? Is the ellipse going to grow bigger or smaller? And so on. But in particular, we can study that using the so-called Hubble function. In particular, we can see how the expansion or contraction of the universe behaves dynamically. For example, when the condition of perfect isotropy, rotation invariant, is relaxed. In this case, we can have different expansions in different directions, non-linearly influencing that. So the situation is, there are solutions known in which the space-time is expanding in some direction much more than in some other direction. And it doesn't just keep going like this, because expansion equations are highly non-linear. You can have that for a while, this direction is expanding more, and this one is lazy, and then after a while, they both expand like mad, and then none of them expands quickly. Everything can happen there. So for example, the expansion in one direction can be enhanced by shear at the expense of another direction. But there could also be an overall expansion or contraction. So let us look at the symmetric part of the expansion. And that was, remember, we decomposed into the antisymmetric part, which was just rotations, or generally Lorentz invariant, a Lorentz rotation, but since it was always spatial, it was just rotation. And then the symmetric part, which was shear plus expansion. This was the part with the trace, and the shear was the traceless part on this. H mu nu was the projector onto the space-like hypersurface orthogonal to the time-like direction. So now, theta mu nu is fully space-like and symmetric, and therefore it can be diagonalized in suitable orthogonal basis, and it will look like that. So this is the expansion in the x direction, expansion in the y direction, in that direction, and if there were only shear, then any one of those could be big as long as the others make up for it, so that in total the trace is zero. If there is overall an expansion or overall a contraction, then those guys need not add up to zero. That's this part over here. So this being the expansion state. And its divergence is what we calculated. Its diverging is what we calculated in the last lecture to show the presence of singularity for cosmological systems. Okay, so the overall expansion then would be the sum of the three expansions, and we define the Hubble expansion, first direction, second direction, third direction, to be a third of those theta parameters in such a way that when we add them all up, we get the overall expansion, and not three times the overall expansion. So then if we use the Hubble expansions in the three basic directions, we can then define scale factors Li and L. So Li dot over Li, where dot is the time derivative, where for the time derivative, we use the fundamental velocity field. Remember, that came from the proof that any physically motivated energy momentum tensor can be brought into a particular special canonical form in which there was this time-like vector field U. And that time-like vector field U is being used here in this study to define what you mean by time direction. So any dot here is really the application of the vector of the time vector of the view. This is the time derivative for us. Okay, so we can define the L dot, we can define those other expansions in the three directions as the other parameters as L dot over L. You hopefully have seen that from a first course in general relativity, that the Hubble parameter is usually just the expansion the scale factor dot over the scale factor. But we do that now separately for each direction. And time derivative is defined in this way. Then finally, we can reap the rewards of all of this. And we can ask, so what do we get? If we do that, if we calculate all those coefficients there, those expansion parameters, for exact solutions. And here's what was found. So the big question is, what behavior can occur in the far past? What sort of Big Bang singularities could we have? The full set of cases is not yet known. We don't know of all things. However, we have explicit solutions which show that behavior. And here we see that there's quite a different, quite a colorful zoo of Big Bang singularities that could have occurred. One possibility is, for example, that all of the scale factors go to zero, and that is probably what everybody has in mind when they think of the Big Bang singularity. All scale factors go to zero. Everything just compresses to no physical extent. Remember that this doesn't mean that the universe contracts to a point. It just means that, I mean, the universe could be at all finite time infinite in extent. It's just that the distance between any two points goes to zero. But at any finite amount of time, you would still have the universe is infinite distance. So it's not one point explosion. The explosion happens everywhere at once. So that would be the case of Li going through, all of the Li going through this. But then there are also explicit solutions to the Einstein equation, which have this behavior here, where L1 and L2, but in two directions, the scale factor goes to zero, everything shrinks to nothing, but in one direction, it blows up. And that's what has been called a cigar singularity, because it's the universe becomes like a cigar. In two directions, it shrinks to nothing, and in one direction, it blows up to infinity. You could also have that the universe behaves such that in two directions, everything shrinks to zero extent, but in the third direction, it stays infinite in size. The magic of nonlinear differential equations. And then you can also have that in two directions, the size goes to a constant. So it doesn't mean that the universe reduces a certain size. It just means that, for example, the distance between galaxies is a finite value, or of any dust grains or whatnot. But in one direction, everything just becomes. So in this case, we would say it's a barrel singularity, because it's a finite size in one direction, but it becomes thinner and thinner and thinner in two directions. And here we have a pancake singularity, because in two dimensions, everything becomes flattened. In two directions, it's a finite size, but then the thickness of that pancake, the two-dimensional pancake, the thickness goes to this. Now, in the case of homogeneous isotropic space-time, so-called Friedmann Lemaître model, the Hubble parameter is simply the sum of the individual ones, and all the three L's behave the same way. But as I said, it's not obvious that the singularity of actual space-time would have been anything like that, because you can have solutions that are for arbitrarily long stretches of time, arbitrarily close to Friedmann's Lemaître solution, and yet then starts deviating significantly towards the past, towards the future. So as far as classical theory is concerned, it's not obvious that if we work with trimethylmetric models, this would necessarily mean that the singularity, classically speaking, would have to be of that type. Principles, nonlinearities could screw things up. Basically, our approximation that we make by saying that space-time is described by a completely homogeneous isotropic model, that approximation might go back as we extrapolate back in time. That's actually, you would see that this is in fact the case. That if we assume homogeneity and isotropy now, then to a certain degree, to a certain precision, then because of the way that the Einstein equation takes, this implies a much more severe assumption about homogeneity and isotropy further in the past. So that it's absolutely not obvious that what now looks like a Friedmann-Lemaître model really was anywhere close to Friedmann-Lemaître model in the first second or so. And that was actually the first reason for why cosmological inflation was considered, because it was observed, and we will get to that, of course, on Thursday, that the assumption of a Friedmann-Lemaître model describing space-time now seems nice and all, but it seems incredibly fine, because if space-time is to be close to Friedmann-Lemaître now, it would have to have started out extremely close to Friedmann-Lemaître very early on. Okay, let's go further in this direction on Thursday. So Thursday is our last session, then it will be a double session, right? And remember that I will be soon traveling, I mean, soon after I will travel to Australia, and it will sometimes be online, but sometimes not. So if you have questions while I'm, the best is ask me while I'm still here. Okay. But other than that, write questions by email. And the better early than late. Okay. Any questions?